Okay. The tape is rolling. Mr. Herzog, before we actually start to talk about your films, I have to ask about something that you talk about in some detail, which I found absolutely fascinating, why traveling on foot has been so central to your life. And I get the sense that your experiences of walking have shaped the way you see the world. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is, but it's very hard to pass it on to anyone else who hasn't traveled on foot. I'm speaking of traveling because I would cover large distances and I would not be a backpacker. I don't carry my tent, my sleeping bag, my cooking utensils, so I do not carry my living room and my kitchen with me. So you are exposed and you have to ask a farmer to sleep in the barn, or you sleep under a bridge, or I would open with little surgical tools, safety locks, and move into an abandoned house or vacation home and lock it up when I leave. And I would leave everything clean and in good shape. I would say traveling on foot has one specific quality, and I can say it only in a dictum. The world reveals itself to those who travel on foot.
How so? I mean, what do you see differently by traveling on foot?
That's what I cannot really explain to those who haven't done it. You have to do it. The world all of a sudden becomes understandable. It reveals itself. It opens itself. You start to focus on the essentials. You are a lot into, while walking, into whole novels, fantasies, music. It's a strange thing, and I advise everyone do some traveling on foot at least once in a while, and the benefits are enormous. And as you know, I run my own film school, the Rogue Film School, which is some sort of a position against what you normally learn in academia. It's a guerrilla type film school, and one of the things I try to hammer in, travel on foot, and other things I try to hammer in, read. If you don't read, you will never be a great filmmaker.
Well, and I'm amused by the description you have of your Rogue Film School, which meets, 3 days during the year or so. And your description it's kind of amazing. You say it's for those who've traveled on foot, who've worked as bouncers in sex clubs or as wardens in a lunatic asylum, for those who are unwilling to learn about who are willing to learn about lockpicking or forging shooting permits in countries not favoring their projects. In short, for those who have a sense of poetry.
Yes, that's all it is.
So not your conventional film school here.
No, it is. It's more about a way of life. And I do not teach anything specific, although I go into samples of films sometimes, or I would show some of the films the students have sent me. They have to send a film, otherwise they wouldn't accept it. And because I do not accept amateurs, they're all professionals who are coming from all over the world, and I would show sometimes some of their films and demonstrate what is wonderful, what is great, and sometimes banalities do not function, like sound, appropriate sound, and I point out and I give technical advice how to handle sound in film, because it doesn't depend on the quality of your microphones. It's an attitude.
An attitude? Looking for particular kinds of sounds?
Yes, I mean, I collect for a cornucopia of sound effects, ambiences, little things that I hear, and I would immediately start to collect like the squirrel. But otherwise, it has to do, number one, select a location that is rather quiet. If you don't have it or if it sounds too hollow, put blankets on the ceiling, on the walls, put felt patches on the soles of the shoes, even on a cup that is being placed on a saucer, because in the dialogue this makes such a noise that you have to repeat things, or you have to do it in a studio again. So it's an attitude, attention to sound. And sometimes I pay more attention to sound than attention to light and camera.
Have you always...
And those are the technical things, or more or less technical things I try to hammer in.
Yeah. Have you always been that sensitive to sound? I mean, even when you were little?
Yes, I have. And the strange fact is when I started to make films 18, 19, there was a group of young filmmakers, and we said, we help each other. You do camera in my film and I help you editing in yours and so on. And of 8 films, 4 never got finished because of sound problems. And that was really revealing to me. And I thought to myself, this seems to be very, very important. And I became aware and I looked at films. Or sometimes when I shoot a scene, sometimes I don't even have to look. And I know by the voice, by the sound, this is good.
Well, you are preaching to the choir here, talking to someone who works in radio. So have you ever wanted to work just doing radio?
No.
No, you need the images.
Yes. Not necessarily, because I think what will remain longer than my films is going to be the things that I write. My prose, books like Conquest of the Useless or Off Walking in Ice. Or now recently I just published a book which is called A Guide for the Perplexed. These written things or poetry that I have written will survive, outlive my films. I'm fairly convinced of it.
That will surprise a lot of people who just admire your films so much. I mean, you know, you are known as a filmmaker.
Yeah, but they haven't read my prose. If you read Off Walking in Ice or Conquest of the Useless, then you would immediately know from first page on, you know, there's something that will live probably longer than the films.
Well, I have to say, A Guide for the Perplexed is absolutely fascinating. I mean, sort of this window into your, not just to your films, but to your philosophy of life, I would say. Now, the first film of yours that I ever saw was Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which was also your big international breakthrough back in the 1970s. And it's a story about an obsessed 17th century Spanish explorer played by Klaus Kinski, who's searching for the golden city of El Dorado. And he becomes unhinged and basically goes mad. Now, I know that you made this film in incredibly difficult conditions in the Amazon jungle, and the stories about your tempestuous relationship with Kinski during the filming are legendary. And I guess I'm wondering how true some of those stories are. I mean, that he shot at and nearly killed some of the extras on film, that at one point you...
Well, yeah. You have to be careful. Don't trust the internet, what's floating around there. I mean, there's a lot of imposters, a lot of voice imitators, a lot of things that people take for granted. There's a very simple thing. My letter to my cleaning lady, a rant against my cleaning lady, number one, I don't have a cleaning lady. And the funny thing is, the author of this rant writes his name right under it. Werner Herzog's letter to his cleaning lady, and then by Scott so-and-so. He even names himself, but people do not see that anymore, and they cannot read context. They do not see that half a line into this rant, it's obvious this is a satire, and it's a well-written satire, but they don't see it, and they rant against me. How can you be so insulting against your cleaning woman? So that's one side. Let's bury that.
So you're saying there are Werner Herzog impersonators out there?
Oh, of course, dozens, Facebooks and Twitters and all sorts of, and they answer back to the audience, and I say I'm not going to worry about it. They are my somehow my bodyguards, my secret bodyguards. Let them be out there. Let them do battle. Let them show all sorts of shades of craziness. So be it.
Okay, so to get back
now,
to this film,
yes,
Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Yes.
Kinski.
Well,
so did you actually threaten to shoot him at one point?
I did, yes. But there was a clear understanding between us. Number one, the production was very, very complicated, and we actually had a very small crew in the middle of the jungle, no support from anywhere, a budget of $360,000 or so, grand total, which is a film which looks like $60-70 million on the screen. So, and it was clear there was a task both for him and for me, and the task itself had more importance than both individuals or even the two of us together. There was some sort of a great duty for us, and he was just always throwing tantrums, destroying the set, insulting people, screaming like mad. So I had to wait until he had screamed himself empty. So something like 10 or 11 days before the end of shooting, he, because a sound assistant smiled and he screamed at me, "This pig has smiled at me." And I had to dismiss him. I said, "No, I'm not going to. The entire crew is going to leave in solidarity." And it was just, and he packed his stuff into a boat and was leaving. And he has left many other film productions or theater productions. He has ruined so much. He has left unfinished films, unfinished business, has recklessly destroyed films and so. And I said to him, "Klaus, I have your rifle. I had to confiscate it because a few days before some of the extras were playing cards after shooting. They were playing cards and they laughed and they had a beer. And he was annoyed by this and shot three shots through their hut, but the walls were only thin bamboo walls. And 40 of them were packed into this small hut. That he didn't kill anyone is a miracle. He only shot half a finger away from one of the extras." And I immediately, I didn't know what had happened, but when I learned what had happened, I confiscated his rifle. It was a Winchester. I still have it, by the way, as one of my prize trophies. And I said to him, "Klaus, you are not going to leave. There's something bigger than the two of us. You will not leave." And he screamed and yelled, "And you will see how I'm going to leave." And I said to him, if you do that, you will just barely reach the next bend of the river and you will have quite a few bullets in your head. So, and he knew I was not joking. I was very calm. By the way, I didn't have a rifle in my hand. It was somewhere in a small hut, thatched hut, which was mounted on a raft because we were floating down a tributary and no village is nothing. We had to live on the raft. And so he kind of understood this was not a joke anymore.
Are you serious? I mean, would you have shot him if he had gotten on that boat
Let's not get into that. But at least I voiced it, and at that time I think I was serious. Otherwise, he wouldn't have all of a sudden screamed for police to protect him against this madman. But I was very calm. I was very, very calm, soft voice. I explained to him that this was not going to happen. And he had some street wisdom. He had some instincts. And he knew that there was a danger out for him.
Yeah.
But of course, you will read everywhere on the internet that from then on I directed him from behind the camera with a rifle pointed at him and all this kind of thing. Let it blossom. Yes, that sounds fine. And it's,
well, and of course, he gives an absolutely brilliant performance. I mean, no one can convey obsession and madness the way Klaus Kinski does. But I have to say, I mean, the fascinating thing is after an experience like that, you and Kinski worked on several more films together. I'm kind of astonished that you'd want to work with him again. I mean, given how difficult he was.
Well, you have to somehow forget about the difficulties in which you are going to get yourself and your crew and the other actors and everyone around. The real question was, what is remaining on a screen for long time to come. And nobody, all the crew who hated him and started to hate me, why do you do this again, this pestilence again on our set? And I said, just you will see in a year from now, you will think about it differently. You will see the film. And number two, all of those who were into Aguirre or Fitzcarraldo or Nosferatu, for them today, it is the greatest experience in their lives. You see, all these, all the turmoil, all the burden of things on your shoulder, they disappear, they dissipate in thin air. And filmmaking is not an easy profession, and I keep telling everyone that's what it is, and let's do it. But every single day on the set, people could see this was going to be big.
Yeah. And people still talk about Aguirre, The Wrath of God, to this day.
Yeah, yeah. People think it's my first film. I made it when I was still very young. Everybody says, I've seen your first film. It's not correct. It was my 11th film.
Hmm. Well, just skip ahead then a few years. You and Kinski were once again in the Amazon filming Fitzcarraldo, another incredibly difficult project. And this is another film about obsession. And the centerpiece of the film is dragging a 340-ton steamboat up a mountain. And the obvious question is...
Over a mountain.
Over a mountain, up and over a mountain. And, you know, the big question is, you know, why did you think that you literally had to drag that ship over a mountain? I mean, you could have created that effect on film, and that's kind of what movies do. They create illusions, but you dragged that ship over the mountain.
At that time when the film was made, there were no digital effects, so let's face it. But, of course, there were possibilities with a miniature boat over a mountain. But how do you miniaturize the trees of the jungle? So that's a tricky thing. Or how do you miniaturize movement waves of water? That's very, very hard to do. But that was not the real issue. For me, it was something more fundamental. I wanted to have audiences back in a position where they could trust their eyes again. And it's a monumental task, and you will never see anything like this in a film, because today they all do it with a digital effect. But moving a real ship over a real mountain created so many lively elements and moments that I captured on film that you couldn't even invent. For example, the sound. When we started to drag the ship and there were steel hawsers, cables and pulley systems around the hull of the boat, and the kind of groaning of the boat and the sounds of the boat is something you will never, ever be able to invent. It's just phenomenal. And so the film became very rich in texture, and I knew that.
And I assume it must have been felt that way for everyone working on the set, actors and the crew, that it was a different experience making the film, having to drag that ship over the mountain.
Yeah, but that was not the only problem out there. I mean, we had everything in the book that can happen, and people always are whining, and they speak about, how plagued their production was. Number one, I'm not in the mood of complaint. I'm not into this climate of complaint. Yes, it was difficult, and it's beautiful what you see, but we had things that normally do not happen in a film production. We had two plane crashes. We had built a big camp for over 1,000 extras in the middle of nowhere, and it was in the north of Peru, close to the Ecuadorian border. And all of a sudden, a border war broke out, and my camp was attacked and burned to the ground, so I had to start all over again. Then I started filming with Jason Robards and Mick Jagger, and I shot half the film, and then Jason Robards became ill. It had to be flown out to the States, and his doctors wouldn't allow him to return. So I had to start all over again from first day one on with a different actor, in this case, Kinski.
And Mick Jagger had to pull out as well. He had to go on tour with the Rolling Stones.
Yes, he had a stop date because he had this Rolling Stones tour. I still had something like a fortnight or almost 3 weeks left on his contract, but I knew until I had a new leading actor, and even if I shot everything around him, I couldn't finish it. It was impossible. So I said to him, Mick, you gotta go. and I will write your part out of the screenplay. He was so phenomenal. He was so good that I didn't want to replace him. I simply wrote his part out of the screenplay.
Now, one of the things that is so extraordinary about your career, and I can't really think of any other filmmaker like this, you have done both feature films and documentaries, I mean, at the highest levels.
It shouldn't give you sleepless nights. Because when you look at writers, for example, why is it, I don't want to compare myself, but I just name him Shakespeare. Why does he write dramas and why does he write sonnets? Or why is a writer writing a novel and poetry? There's nothing special about that.
But it would seem that these are two very different things. I mean, one would presume that documentaries are grounded in the imperative to talk about real things, and feature films are dealing with fiction.
No, I do not accept your definition, because that's what you see day in, day out on HBO and PBS and so. It's a form of journalism. You are talking about a form of journalism, and I think documentaries have to divorce themselves from journalism. Errol Morris is doing it. Les Blank did it. I'm doing it. And I think my basic approach is facts do not constitute truth. That's a common mistake. They don't. Otherwise, the phone directory of Manhattan, 4 million entries, would be the book of books. It would be scripture, and it is not. So I'm looking after something that is only partially based in fact, but I stylize, I invent, I script, I write some of the scenes. I do everything that goes much closer towards, let's say, feature filmmaking.
Are you in pursuit?
Be inventive.
Are you in pursuit of truth in your documentary?
In a
films?
Way, yes, but you have to be very cautious about it, because neither mathematicians or philosophers could really define what it is. But we all have this sense in us, and what I'm trying is to move towards in this direction. And truth is something which has to illuminate you. There are moments of almost ecstasy where you step out of yourself and you immediately sense there's something very, very big, and it becomes part of yourself. And I have coined the term the ecstasy of truth, the ecstatic truth. And many of the young filmmakers are picking it up now, and they have understood that the fact-based films of the 60s, the so-called cinema vérité, was the answer of the 60s. But today we have moved on with a huge, massive, monumental onslaught on our sense of facts and truth. And you can tell virtual reality on internet. There's nothing truthful. It's all invented. Whatever, reality TV, WrestleMania, it's all choreographed, Photoshop. So we have to question and ask ourselves as filmmakers, in which direction do we have to move? What is our answer today, 2014? We have to find a new answer. If we don't, we'll be stuck in the reflex of the 1960s, Vietnam War, and cinema vérité, fact-oriented, journalistic-oriented cinema.
So
in documentaries.
Have you had many personal experiences of this yourself, of these ecstatic moments of truth?
Yes, I of course, and I think everyone has these moments. When you read a great poem, you instantly know. You don't have to analyze it. Or being confronted with a great painting, you just are completely awestruck and you are transported somewhere which is as if you have lifted off the ground and you are somewhere and you are confronting this image. It happens, or in music, great music, it has, not only can it illuminate you, it also has a quality that's particular about music. It can give you consolation.
I'm interested in all the examples you've given are not about your own films that you make.
No, but I'm trying to find these moments, and I'm striving for a cinema that gives you this kind of illumination at least once in a while. Mm-hmm. And also a sense of solitude, that all of a sudden you don't feel alone anymore.
I want to ask you about a couple of your documentaries.
Yeah.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams, about the ancient cave paintings in the French cave Chauvet, created 30,000 years ago. And I've been in some of these ancient French caves, not Chauvet, but a couple of the others. And the artistry is breathtaking. I mean, it's just astounding that people created this kind of art. And the whole setting, I mean, this kind of the darkness, the otherworldly nature, it must have been very mysteriously lit as they created these drawings. What did you make of that cave art when you saw it?
I can put it in one single word: awe. You're just awestruck. 32,000 years ago, there were people, the very first paintings that we ever have. The next paintings come 15, 16, 17,000 years later that we know, and those are the caves you have probably visited. So it's a sense of awe, and if cinema can transport it and pass it on, then you have reached everything. My cinematographer asked me, how do we deal with this? How do we do this? And I said to him, if we manage to get this awe across to an audience, then we have done everything we had to do.
Did you find this to be a sacred space, the inside the caves in Chauvet?
You have to be very careful with that. I'm not into this New Age pseudo-philosophical babble. Yeah. These are rituals in sacred places and all those things. Now, I had to be functional. I had very short time. I had enormous restrictions. I couldn't move off 2-foot-wide metal walkway. I couldn't put my tripod wherever I wanted. I had 4 hours a day for a week. I had no support from outside. In 3D, only 3 people could be with me. And so it's an enormous pressure. I had to deliver. I had to function and deliver. So you cannot think much. But I have been in the cave before without cameras. And all I can say, this was one of the great moments of awe. And I got it across in the film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if I had to guess, I mean, you strike me as someone who is not religious. You don't seem to have any metaphysical beliefs that we normally associate with a religion, but you seem to be fascinated by what I would call the religious imagination, by looking for, I guess, what is holy in people and in the world around us.
That's probably a better definition. And I like what you are saying. And yes, that's a feeling that you get when you see the film. There's something that transports you, that and holiness, I say it in quotes, and let's touch this term only with a pair of pliers. Yes, it has certain qualities that can, like a flame, jump across from a painting to a spectator, or from one person to another person. It does happen, and cinema is at its very, very best.
Did you feel a kinship between what you do as a filmmaker today and what these people did 30,000 years ago, creating that art?
In a way, yes, because you can clearly see this is the beginning of modern man. You feel that they have things they've painted and done, things that have passed on to us as a collective memory, a deep historical memory. For example, you've got a bison, a galloping bison, and the bison has 8 legs. And tens of thousands of years later, in old Nordic mythology, the horse of the main god Odin, named Sleipnir, is the fastest horse ever seen to anyone. And the horse is so fast because it has eight legs. Or, for example, there's one strange painting, the lower part of a female body and a bison almost embracing it. And tens of thousands of years later, Picasso makes a series of paintings, Le Minotaur et la Femme, the Minotaur, the bull and the woman. And it's very, very much alike, although, of course, Picasso had not seen Jouvet Cave. And there are cultural memories passed on to us and a sense of time that is staggering. For example, there are, I think, some reindeer unfinished in charcoal. And you can, through radiocarbon dating, you can pretty exactly define when this was made. And it's overpainted, finished and overpainted by, I think, a woolly mammoth. And now science has established that one painter started the reindeer and another painter completed it, and it was 5,000 years later.
Wow, that's amazing.
Just staggering.
Yeah. Well, didn't Picasso, after he went to see the paintings in Lascaux, he said something like, we've learned nothing since then.
It is true, because the paintings in Jouvet Cave or in Lascaux in the south of France are so accomplished and they are so modern and they are so lively that we can only step back and hold our breath and acknowledge this is us.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you about one other documentary that you did, which is everyone I know talks about this, is kind of obsessed about it. It's the story of Timothy Treadwell, who for years went to live with grizzly bears in Alaska pretty much every summer, until one summer when he and his girlfriend were killed and eaten by a grizzly. As a filmmaker, why did you want to tell that story?
I had no idea about the events around Timothy Treadwell. I had never heard of him. And in the office of a producer who was very friendly with me and was very helpful, I paid him a courtesy visit. And at the end of our conversation, I was looking at his messy table, looking for my car keys that I had misplaced. And he thought I was spotting something in particular, and he shoves across an article about Timothy Treadwell and said, read this, read it at home. I normally don't read this. I went home, read it. I was right back in the office because I had the feeling this was big. This was so big, I had to do this. And I somehow wrestled the whole project away from them, and I did it together with them. But it was, you can tell as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you know it deep inside that you come across something that is truly big. And the film has had a lot of impact.
Well, and Treadwell, I mean, he's this fascinating character because he's, I mean, you admire him for what he did he himself was a filmmaker. He shot amazing footage of the grizzlies, but you know, there was something odd and probably off about him as well. I mean, he should not have gotten that close to the grizzlies.
Sure. Yes. There are rules of behavior in the native population, for example, in Kodiak Island. They respect the bear. They don't love the bear, but they respect the boundaries. But Timothy Treadwell wanted to hug them and even touch their nose and sing songs to them. So there's something wrong, something awfully and tragically gone awry, where the Disneyization of wild nature ultimately cost him his life and, unfortunately, also his girlfriend's life, Amy Hugenard, who was with him. It's very, very tragic, a tragic sort of misunderstanding of philosophy and misunderstanding of wild nature. And of course, when you say, yeah, he was kind of unhinged and sometimes glorious, and so he had at least 5, 6, 7 more facets, a very strange, colorful man with a lot of different sides in him. And I allow him to show all his sides, his glory, his dejection, his fears, his magnanimity, everything. Madness, everything.
Now, one of the things that makes this film so poignant is it turned out that Timothy Treadwell's camera was on as he was getting killed, he and his girlfriend. I mean, the lens wasn't open, but the audio was going, and there are 6 minutes of audio as he's getting mauled and eaten by the bear. And so the question for you is, what do you do with that? I mean, how do you deal with that morally?
You can see it in the film. I had to address it because production company, TV station, which sponsored the film, and the distributor, they all came to me and they said, you have to address it. It is known in public. Why don't you play it in the film? I said to them, I have no idea what's really on this tape. Let me listen to it and I'm going to film this moment. But I'm filmed only from behind. And you see the face of Jewel Palovac, who was a companion and co-founder of Grizzly People, and she inherited all these tapes. And she tries to read from my face what I'm hearing, and she starts, it's a very intense moment, she starts to cry, and I listen to the tape. And the moment I listened to it, I knew this is not going to be in my film, never ever. That's not going to happen. It's the same thing. Why do we not show in public on television after the 9/11 attacks? And today is the anniversary. We are speaking on the 11th of September. 200 people jumping out of the towers to their death. Some of them in close-ups, crashing to the ground in front of a camera. There's a dignity to one's individual's death and a privacy. You will never, ever show this in public. And a similar thing, you have to respect the death of these two persons. And it is so terrifying, by the way, it's so terrifying what I heard, that certain things you do not put out to an anonymous audience. You just don't. And there's a clear line, and I said, only over my dead body, this is going to end up in the film. And they understood it.
But you felt like you had to listen yourself.
Well, I was pushed to, and yes, there was a certain curiosity, and I can say one or two things. On the tape, you hear Timothy Treadwell in the distance screaming. And apparently Amy Huguenard, a petite woman who was from moment one on afraid of grizzly bears, she apparently grabbed a frying pan, rushed out and hit the bear with this frying pan over the head. And at the place where some of her remains were found, there was also the frying pan. So this is real heroism. And she lost her life, but she lost it as a true, genuine, authentic hero.
Do you still think a lot about Timothy Treadwell?
He comes across me whenever I see an animal, a wild animal, or whenever I see wilderness. He's always there.
Are there other people like that in films you've done? I mean, sort of people who are, I don't know, touchstones in a way for you?
They all have become part of my existence. Part of what I am is in my films, and of course, persons with whom I worked who are showing up in the films. That's a wonderful thing. But of course, those whom you see are the actors, and I respect them, and I learned a lot of them. And by the way, I do some acting once in a while.
Right.
And I must say, I love it. I love everything that has to do with cinema. And of course, some of it is a little bit of self-mocking. I was in Parks and Recreation in a small cameo role just a fortnight ago. And I have no idea what the series is all about, but it's a very funny moment. And I like these moments, playing the real dangerous, frightening villain in Jack Reacher with Tom Cruise. So I really enjoy everything, writing, screenplays, editing, you just name it.
One final question. Do you have a dream film project you've always wanted to do but just haven't gotten to for whatever reason?
There are quite a few, and let's not go into naming each one. Fact is, I have made some 70 films. Of course, there are two or three projects that I could never manage to do, but while I'm sitting here and I'm just finishing a film, Queen of the Desert, five other projects have invaded me already, and they are chasing me and coming wildly, swinging at me like in the middle of the night. So I'm so full of other projects that I would not waste 15 years now to wait for the financing to come through for a film that I can't make. So no complaints. I'm not in this culture. I just plow on.
thank you.
And it's a great joy to plow on, let's face it.
Yes. Thank you. This is wonderful.
And greetings to Wisconsin, which is one of my three favorite states.
Oh,
Colorado, Wisconsin, Alaska. Wisconsin, and I'm speaking not of Madison, I'm speaking of Nekoosa, of Stevens Point, Wisconsin, of these places in the middle of nowhere. Everything south of Appleton.
We are actually south of Appleton too. So
it's a wonderful country.